Well, thank you very much. It was my impression that we should start the discussion not just from where we are, but on some common grounds, and therefore I proposed these two introductory statements from two sides, and then we should try to converse and see where we go. I must confess that I feel somewhat exploited and oppressed by this tape recorder here, but if this is the case in the land of the tapes, then okay. This conversation has certainly not the intention to liberate us from liberation theology. I'm sorry that we are discussing this in absentia of those who are more engaged in this, perhaps, than we are. My question is, well, first of all, that my situation is not Africa, not Latin America, and not the United States of America. My situation is not a situation of economic exploitation, not a situation of severe political oppression or racial disregard. My situation in which I live at Tübingen University is in the midst of an more or less affluent, white West Europe, common market, NATO, etc. And I am, as you can see, middle class, white, male, European, and some other things also. So am I allowed to speak about a theology of liberation? That is the first question, I believe. Certainly, I'm not allowed to speak in the same way of a theology of liberation as black Christians do it in South Africa, for example, nor as my Latin American friends do it in Latin America. But the question is, don't we white, middle class, male, etc. people, don't we need also a liberation to a more meaningful life, a liberation to live out our destiny as the image of God on earth? I believe, and I have said this several times, that there are many messianic works in the messianic mission of Jesus. One is certainly, if we follow Luke 4:18 following, the liberation of the oppressed and to set free the captives. And another one is to make the blind or the blinded see, and to make the apathetic people sensitive. And I believe that in my situation, I have to work on a kind of liberation theology in order to make the blind or the blinded around me see as much as I can see, namely that we live and still go on living on the costs of others. And as long as we do that, we are not free. We need a liberation from that. So one direction is to preach the gospel of the kingdom to the poor, and another direction is to call with the gospel those into conversion, repentance, discipleship, who are not poor. And this other direction, I believe, we must work out in our situation. But now we have the theme, theology of liberation, and as a systematic theologian, I should bring my skills and what I have learned into it to find out what theology is in this phrase, theology of liberation. Theology certainly has to do with God, and a theology of liberation views all individual sufferings and denials in the world against the background of the suffering of God. It thus views all partial liberation movements as on the horizon of God's total and final history of liberation, the same what in earlier times was called the history of salvation, which is inclusive, universal, and is what the history between God and the world is all about. A theology of liberation which witnesses to God's suffering and God's freedom can be deeply significant, I believe, for individual liberation movements in at least three ways. First, we may not think trivially about the issues of freedom. We must dissolve our egoism and to begin to think in terms of others, even the enemies of our own freedom. Normally we think exclusively and we must learn to think inclusively. Or we think particularistic and we must learn to think universalistic. That is, if we speak about freedom, it's first of all the freedom of those who are denied the rights to freedom, and that's not our own freedom we have to think about. Now it is understandable that in its daily struggles, every liberation movement is somewhat determined by its opposition. Whoever was in such a movement knows that. As a result, it begins to follow the law of reciprocity and even revenge. But this corrupts the very freedom and humanity for which it struggles. The alienations which coercively emerge in such struggles must again be overcome if one wants to remain credible and demonstrate a better justice. Is the necessary revolutionary rigidity to be eliminated in the confrontation, or is it actually to be eliminated only after the revolution? Herbert Marcuse answered this question of a Berlin student in 67 with a genuine sensitivity, I believe, for the disturbance which proceeded from Jesus. His answer was, "Nothing is more atrocious than sermonizing about love. Do not hate your enemy, in a world in which hate is thoroughly institutionalized." Marcuse called hate against exploitation and oppression itself a humane and humanistic principle. But if justified hate against exploitation is not accompanied by hope for the birth of humanity within the exploiter, revolution increasingly resembles repression. And therefore, I believe revolutionary rigidity must be eliminated already in the confrontation itself. A liberated humanity, the new humanity, the liberation theology is heading to, cannot be eschatologically postponed to a date after the revolution. That would be a self-made, man-made parousieverzögerung. A Christian theology of liberation lives by anticipating humanness in the midst of inhumanity and by stimulating reconciliation in the midst of the struggle for the redemption of this as yet unredeemed world. Now, at this point, one must make clear that from a Christian perspective, reconciliation and liberation are not in opposition. Reconciliation with the God of liberation means struggle against oppression in the world, just as peace with God means discord with a world without peace. Now, the second point I would like to raise in terms of a theological reflection on liberation is, when it comes to the issues of liberation, we must overcome our ideological fixation with our own interests. It is regrettable that a conflict has broken out between the various liberation movements over what constitutes the root of all evil. Socialists maintain that capitalism is a source of all evil and would view racism and sexism merely as capitalistic epiphenomena. Others consider the primary distress to be racial humiliation. And representatives of women's liberation are sometimes view sexual oppression as a beginning of all oppressions. And finally, ecologists find the pattern of all exploitation already in the exploitation of the resources of nature. So this conflict reminds one of the philosophical debate of pre-Socratics over primal matter and whether it is to be found in water, air, or fire. This is a kind of negative metaphysics, and this has resulted from such ideological fixation. Only occasionally is a question asked in the books we have at hand, why and how human beings come to capitalistic, racial, and sexist aggression. In most situations, human beings are more or less trapped in mutual conditioning. Everywhere, only on the borders not, but everywhere, I believe, we find oppressed oppressors who aggressively pass on to others the suffering which they themselves have experienced. And this is a chain without an end or a beginning. The Christian understanding of evil sees at work in, with, and under the various oppressions a primal anxiety. And this primal anxiety is constantly changed into aggression. With this perspective, a Christian liberation theology will not denigrate actual liberation movements from this or that evil. Rather, it will seek to eliminate ideological fixation and will press for cooperation. The struggle for liberation is always a self-critical struggle. Only a few can say, at least from between us, I believe, that they are totally oppressed persons and not in other connections themselves oppressors. The anti-capitalist struggle does not lead to a new humanity if it is not simultaneously a struggle against political dictatorship, against racism, and against sexism. It does not lead to a new humanity if it does not emerge out of the experience liberation from that primal anxiety and aggression which is more or less in all of us. Today, the vicious circles of oppression are constituted out of many links, and without an alliance of the liberating powers, these circles can never be broken. The third remark is, freedom is an extraordinary blessing, but also a very dangerous one. Even as we cry out for freedom, it causes us anxiety. The risk of freedom in an unjust world is tremendous. In order to enter into freedom, we need, therefore, an unbending hope which would rather be disappointed than disappoint others, and a strong confidence which would rather let itself be wounded than wound others. Whoever helps those who are lost is himself lost, said Bertolt Brecht in The Good Man from Sichuan. Indeed, whoever is ready for freedom must be ready for the cross. The messianic mystery of freedom is seldom revealed in this world other than as dying and behold we live. Freedom in the cross, that is, I believe, the gospel, for Christ is not the regulator of the world, but our deadly freedom, as Reinhold Schneider, a Catholic poet who was in the resistance movement against Hitler, put it once, Christ, our deadly freedom. And one must become as clear as possible about the risk of freedom and the costs of freedom. I say this because many enthusiastic liberation movements have been ruined by their superficial optimism, and if it didn't work, then people move to something else. Without a hope against hope, which is born out of the readiness for suffering and the cross, resistance and confidence do not gain any firm ground. So, on the basis of these three little remarks, I would then suggest that we see the liberation which is necessary in from a holistic perspective, because it is meaningless to drive out one devil with another. This is not a liberation. So if not the whole of humanity and the whole of the person is liberated, then we do not have a liberation at all. And I would see the dimensions of liberation which are necessary in our situation, wherever we are, now with different points of entry in the specific situation in which we live, in the following five dimensions: in the struggle for economic justice against the exploitation of man, and the real symbol for this is what is, at least in Europe, called socialism. Second, the struggle for human dignity and human rights against political oppression, and the real symbol for that is what we call democracy. And then this number three, the struggle for human solidarity against the cultural and sexual and racial alienation of human beings from human beings. And the real symbol for that is solidarity. And number four, the struggle for peace with nature against the industrial destruction of nature. And number five, the struggle of hopes against anxiety and apathy in our personal life. And I believe we should relate these things to one another. The first two dimensions I would relate in the way Rosa Luxemburg did it against Lenin, with her famous statement, "No socialism without democracy, no democracy without socialism." And some of the Latin American theologians who promote a liberation theology in terms of socialism, I believe, to more or less overlook the democratic dimension in politics, which is simply necessary. If you just move from feudalism to socialism, then you keep normally the feudalistic structures, and that's not a very good progress. Then comes the point of solidarity in the racial and sexual alienation of human beings, etc. Here's a point of discussion between me and my friend Jim Cohn with the black theology, because if one emphasizes black liberation, black identity, then one is necessarily confronted with the economic question that in the black community there are lower class, middle class, and upper class people, and they have a common identity over against another race, but the identity in their own group can only be established if these economic class divisions are overcome. So there's no black liberation theology which leads very far, I believe, without a dimension of socialism in it to overcome these new classes which arise in the black community. And I could go on so with some critical remarks, but I will spare myself at this point to say at the end, especially the more socialistic elements in the liberation theology lead to the idea that the improvement of conditions of life on the economic, political, cultural level would improve the human person. And I think this can lead to a materialistic illusion. Men and women are more than just a conglomerate of their objective conditions. Let me put it in this way. Aeschylus, not to quote Karl Marx all the time, Aeschylus said that a man loses half of his virtue in slavery. And this is right. But he did not say that man gains half of his virtue in freedom. In other words, while exploited, oppressed, and alienated human beings are very often just the result of bad conditions, liberated human beings are not the result of better conditions. Bad conditions force us to evil things, since they leave us without possibilities, but good conditions do not force us to the good, since whether or not we then realize these free possibilities depend entirely on ourselves. And therefore, this personal dimension comes in again and cannot be reduced to the social dimension or the political dimension. It then becomes a very personal question how to realize the better conditions in which we live. Let me end this. Without a cooperation between and among the powers of liberation on the social dimension, the political dimension, and the cultural dimension, and the others, without cooperation, we will never see a piece of freedom, not to speak about the kingdom of freedom. And I believe that we hear the divine call into freedom only when we hear the universal cry for freedom and make this cry wholly and not merely partially our own. And this holistic aspect, I believe, a theology of liberation must bring into the particular struggles in which we are involved in order to give these struggles a universal meaning, not in order to dissolve or to relativize any one of these struggles in which we are.
I have been looking forward to this opportunity to enter into discussion with Professor Moltmann and with you around what I hope we can find to be a serious theological issue. I'm not sure that it will be easy or possible for this discussion to take place. First of all, because I think Professor Moltmann and I start out from two very different points. Professor Moltmann, if I understand correctly what he has just said, wants to talk with you about and me about what he knows. I want to talk with you and with him about what I don't know. And that is where I think the issue may really require some struggle for understanding. Let me try to say what I mean. I sympathize very much with Eugen Rosenstock Husey, whom some of you may know through his writings, who, while he was sitting in the trenches of Verdun in the First World War, decided that a European civilization had arrived at the end of an era, that none of the formulations of the questions that had been developed in a European history were any longer valid or had any possibility to move to the future, and that from that moment on, the question of the intellectual was the problem of trying in intense interaction and speech with others to discover what the new questions were that needed to be asked and how to begin to wrestle with them, knowing that you had no answers. And Rosenstock Husey spent most of his life writing about the possibility of people who are struggling to find the right questions speaking to each other in such a way that they give life to each other and open up a possibility of serious, critical interaction. Well, I regret that it took me about 30 years more than it took Rosenstock Husey to come to that conclusion. 30 years and living in Brazil and in this country for quite a while. But where I start at is precisely the point that he arrived at in the trenches of Verdun. That to deal with the problem of human liberation today forces us to try to discover what really are the questions we're asking. And to realize that we don't have the answers, we don't even quite know what the questions are, but that is not a counsel of despair, that is an opening to a new future. Because we have the possibility to begin living and interacting with each other in our struggles of liberation and discovering how to speak to each other in a language that may be very, very tentative, that we have to use one day and discard another, but which opens up the possibility of communication and construction and an ongoing process of change. Now, the second thing I want to say is that I think that Professor Moltmann and I can identify a theological problem of importance. Whether we can talk to each other about it or not, I'm not quite sure, given the fact what I've just said. But I'd like to follow this through by trying to identify one very specific problem which I think is relevant when we deal with the issue of liberation. Because when I begin thinking about the struggle for human liberation today, I don't think about Latin America or the blacks or anybody else who is outside of my situation. I think of myself living in the technological, technocratic, post-industrial society we are in America today, which as far as I'm concerned is squeezing the life out of us and making us its victims. And the problem of liberation is the problem of how we can break out of the closed world which we have created for ourselves in this highly technological and technocratic society. And I think that what Professor Moltmann has written and spoken shows a very precise focus for getting at that particular problem. Because in a situation that is closed in, the question for me about the power of Christian faith is the question of its power to speak a messianic language that breaks open a closed world. I was looking the other day in Theology of Hope, in which Professor Moltmann said, whether or not Christianity has a future depends upon whether or not it can credibly present in a changing world the future open before it by the by its origin and its lore. Well, that's the issue. What I see in America today is that we are victims of a culture in which we have lost the possibility of speaking a messianic language to each other. We, and I think the presidential debates of the other night are by far the most devastating example of what I mean. But we don't have to go that far. We can stay right here in Princeton. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we are more and more products of a culture in which our language, our structures of rationality, our values, our economic and social and political structures are the product of a of the trends and development of a technocratic society that may be the death of us. And yet we continue to play the same games determined by those structures, the logic, and the trends of that society, because we simply have no way of speaking or reflecting on our situation except in the terms that are given to us by the closed world we're a part of. And this is not only true in society, it is also true, by and large, in the church. The church has, by and large, lost its capacity to speak a word that breaks open the situation in which we are enclosed. Now, the question that I would therefore like to propose for us this evening for discussion is, how is it possible for the resources of theology to provide us with a messianic language in this situation we are in America, or if Professor Moltmann prefers to speak about Germany, well and good. But this is the situations of which we are a part. It's interesting that in the address which Professor Moltmann gave for the convocation, he spoke about a messianic lifestyle, and the illustration that he used of this was what is happening in Korea today. I was reminded of a dissertation which Youngbak Kim wrote 2 years ago here at Princeton about the way in which the messianic lifestyle that has developed in Korea at this time has happened because for the last 100 years, the language of Christian faith, especially through the Bible, has penetrated into the language of the people and has become a messianic language which has broken open the closed world of Confucianism, has become incorporated in religious movements which have inserted themselves into history and in the Tonghak movement and in the March 1st independence movement, made this messianic language of Bible and of Christian faith a powerful political language for transformation.